Hey, good day, and welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. Today, I'm joined by two of the three of the four of us, Wade McFaul or Wade McFowl, depending upon where in the country you live and how you say his name, retired assistant special agent in charge from the OIG out of the LA office and currently a member of our SIU investigative team. Jason Eisengrind, also retired executive from HHS OIG, and the retired Western UPIC director and our special director in charge. Matt Kachansky is off on much needed PTO for the week. And I am still Eric Rubenstein, senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse. For today's episode, we really want to talk about a couple of interesting things that all focus around something called TPE, Targeted Probe and Education, which is a CMS-directed project that starts with the MACs. Now, for those of you that don't know what that is, I want to share my screen for a minute and give people an opportunity to understand what TPE is. Targeted Probe and Education is a MAC-directed project where providers are chosen. You receive a letter from your Medicare administrative contractor to review 20 to 40 claims. That 20 to 40 claim number comes directly as it relates to the CMS program integrity manual regarding probe audits and the like. And what happens is that if you get selected for a probe investigative audit, typically from the UPIC, a probe review will be 20 to 40 claims, unlike a statistically valid random sample using RATSTATS, which is typically 100. So in discussions that I've had previously with people where they ask, why is that number 20 to 40? The reason is that it mirrors the program integrity manual as it relates to that. And so what typically happens, let me unshare my screen so we can have a conversation about this. What typically happens is that the MAC will request 20 to 40 claims. They conduct what's known as the targeted provider education. They review those claims. And if there are denials for those services, the provider is then given an opportunity to have one-on-one education. One of the things that interests me in looking at this, and I'll reshare my screen, is that you see here in the bottom right-hand corner, it says if some claims are denied, you'll be invited to a one-on-one education session. You know, to me, I find that a little perplexing because CMS is typically pretty specific about things. And when they talk about some claims, now some could mean one, some could mean all, and it's not really well-defined. But the point being is that if a provider has an error rate on a claim, they're able to get a one-on-one session with a billing and coding educator to learn what the issue was and correct that issue. The way that the TPE process normally works is that providers are given three rounds of this targeted provider education. And what winds up happening is that after three rounds of TPE, if the provider still has a high failure rate or high error rate, and that also isn't really defined, but I think generally speaking in the CMS guidance, it's generally defined as something greater than 50% on that error rate, that a provider can then be referred to the UPIC for action by the UPIC. And that action could mean anything from being put on a prepay for a particular code, a prepay for 100% of their codes, and also for additional investigative action leading to potentially to a referral to the OIG. So Wade, I want to start with you because obviously the issue here is intent. When we're talking about a criminal investigation, one of the biggest stumbles and most difficult things from a criminal investigative perspective is being able to show indicia of fraud, waste, and abuse, the intent piece. Now, as we all know, we don't make determinations like that. That's a prosecutorial decision, right? Because that's a proof. But obviously, from an investigator's perspective, we're bringing cases to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And even now in your role as part of our SIU team on one of our Medicaid contracts, you're looking for things that are indicative of the intent, right? When you're going to the MFUCU, because you're working on a contract on a Medicaid contract, you're having to make your pitch to the MFUCU to show intent. And I'm thinking, you know, TPE failure, which leads to a referral, can possibly be one of those pieces. But so two things that I want to turn over to you is one is from the ASAC perspective, right? You have to vet all of these to identify whether or not you're going to look to return these back to the UPIC or the MAC, close the case, if you're going to assign it to an agent. So the first thing is like the vetting of that failure, things like prior history with the provider. And then even now in your current position, like some of those pieces of the puzzle. So talk a little bit about like, you know, how these things, the interplay of things like a TPE, prior education, prior overpayments and the like all factor into those investigative considerations.
Okay, so I think I would start by just backing up a little bit and talking about some of the things that, I'm looking for when I'm vetting leads or potential referrals. And we've talked about this on other podcasts, but one of the first things is if there's beneficiary or member harm, if the patient is being harmed in some way, that puts it kind of at the top of the list of something that we have to look at, and we have to look at it, you know, expeditiously. The other thing we look at is the potential overpayment or like the case value. Each different region, or more specifically, each different judicial district has thresholds, and oftentimes they're not written down, they're not delineated, they're not going to say it's got to be over $1 million or over $50,000, depending on the judicial district, but they're kind of known numbers. So that's something you look at. If it's, you know, it's a case that might get prosecuted in, I don't know, Kansas City for a certain dollar amount, and the prosecutors in Los Angeles wouldn't even look at it unless it's, you know, generally over $1 million. So that's another thing to look at. But then we get into the egregiousness and the, you know, you're looking at something versus like identity theft versus maybe just like overutilization. That's another factor. But then you really get into what we're talking about here, and that's intent. For a case to be worked, or more specifically prosecuted criminally, that's the main thing that we have to show, is that they intended to violate that statute. And a lot of times that can be the make or break of the case. If we can't prove intent, we can work the case civilly, which has a lower burden of proof. But going back to the intent, if we've had previous TPE and the provider has talked to a CPC, a coder, or somebody who really knows what they're talking about from the MAC, if they have that and they've had that three times, and then the MAC or the UPIC works it up, it goes along the road and it ends up on my desk and I'm deciding whether or not to assign it, that's a huge plus, because they can't use, a lot of times they just say, oh, these Medicare regulations are so confusing, I didn't know what I was doing, I didn't understand that. If you've had three sessions of TPE, I think it's going to be pretty easy in most cases to prove that intent. Is that a part of your background?
Right. I mean, from my perspective, the purpose of TPE is behavior modification, right? And, you know, I had a guy that trained me as an agent who once said that our jobs are not to be special agents at the OIG. Our jobs are to be antisocial behavior modification specialists. And, you know, there's a lot of truth, you know, in that, because when you look at it, when you look at things like TPE and provider education and all of that, the goal of any of those things, education and training, are really geared towards creating a pattern of behavior. How do you act or react to something? And so I think that's, you know, the TPE piece, which didn't exist years and years ago, it's, you know, I think it existed, then it went away, but it's kind of back in action, is really to kind of create that behavior modification. And I see behavior modification is going to be one of two ways. A provider is either going to change their behavior and bill in accordance, or document and bill in accordance with the training and education, or they're going to stop what they're doing entirely, right? And I think from certain perspectives, either way works, right? If your behavior changes such that you bill and code and document commensurate with what the training and education is telling you, then a goal has been achieved. If you entirely stop billing for that item, service, or procedure, or you change the behavior, for example, if you're always billing a level 4, a level 5 E&M, if the training and education doesn't take, but you say, well, It's just not my trouble. I'm going to bill everything as a level two or level three and get off the radar. It's worth not having to make the extra 50, 60, 80 bucks to just have someone off my back. Then that goal has kind of been achieved in a little bit of both ways. But so one little interesting piece, which is I think something that kind of connects into this, is there's something out there called the CERT, right? CERT is the Comprehensive Error Rate Testing. And that's a, you know, that's a Medicare instituted, a CMS instituted, not to be confused with PERM, which is on the Medicaid side, but just for the fiscal, for the year, the reporting year of July of 20 to June 30th of 2021, this is the most recent reporting that you can see that the overall improper payment rates, 7.6% with a $31 billion error rate, meaning that CMS and the Medicare program inappropriately paid $31 billion because the error rates are here in, you know, greater than 8%. And I know, you know, we're talking a little bit about this before we got on to make the recording, is that in the E&M world, the error rates are even higher. You know, I've seen some studies that have shown that the error rates are as high as 40 or 42% on E&Ms. And so there is a lot of error that's out there. But Jason, I want to go to you because what happens in the TPE world is that after a provider has failed three rounds of education and training, the MACs will make referrals to the UPICs and basically say, hey, this is no longer our problem. This problem child provider or clinic or group, whatever it is now the UPICs problem, which now gets to this other whole thing, which is that the UPICs didn't initiate this work. The UPICs didn't ask for this work. This becomes one of the things that now becomes a UPIC problem, which then gets into resource allocation. So, you know, it now becomes the issue of, is it really the provider? You know, how do we know that the education and training that the provider was getting was good, bad, or indifferent? I know on the UPIC side, there's a lot of training and education that goes on, but this really does become a resource allocation issue, right?
Yes, indeed it does. And I think, like Wade, I like to just back it up and really look at this globally, because I think that it's very interesting that this discussion dovetails into several other podcast discussions that we've had. It's about case prioritization. It's about resource management. It's about the effective use of resources. And also the, what are we here to do? We're here for program integrity purposes. So whether it's an SIU or UPIC or the OIG or the FBI or any other agencies that might be looking at this, this effort, we have to keep in mind that, and for those of us that are from the law enforcement community, I'll just suggest that program integrity efforts are like a force continuum. What amount of force is necessary to correct the behavior that you, Eric, brought up? So, you know, not everybody that has an infraction or maybe not billing in the most optimal fashion goes to jail, nor should they go to jail, right? So, and I'll just say as a plug for OI, that was one of the cool things about OIG as a law enforcement agency, is that it does criminal, civil, and administrative investigations. And not many, if any, other federal agencies have the capability to do the administrative. So in some circumstances, TPE is a way to gather good information. But we as managers and leaders of SIUs, of OIGs, of advise efforts, we have to recognize that we have a limited amount of resources. What are we going to though get as a result of that effort? So in a probe, you're really only going to get, you can't extrapolate from a probe, or at least I don't think you should be able to extrapolate in a probe. Maybe in some dynamic that's happening, I wouldn't personally agree with that, because there isn't a surety of what that level of poor billing is doing across the board, but does it give good information to establish cause to apply other resources? Absolutely. Does it give some amount of overpayment? Yeah, absolutely. Does it also set the stage, as you've already said, for information that shows intent? Absolutely. So there are good reasons for it, but it's not the only reason, because the program integrity effort is a spectrum of things, and you got to go into the toolbox and draw out the thing that's going to be most applicable to the concern that's at hand. So certainly if the concern at hand is that members are dying from some services that are being applied, I don't know that TPE is where I would go. I'm not saying I would never do it, but it's certainly, it's not going to be the level of force correction that's needed. So it's really about the whole project of program integrity, and TPE is one of those efforts.
Right. And I don't think anybody is suggesting that if there's an allegation involving patient harm, that a provider should be in, like, that's a whole different ball of wax. We're talking about some issues involving, straight billing and coding related things. But, one of the points that you kind of alluded to was the fact that TPE shouldn't just be a government mandated or government instituted program, right? Commercial payers and SIUs as part of that continuum in program integrity. And we're seeing this with a lot of advisors clients, that a lot of our SIU work is really hitting this continuum of program integrity, that no longer is SIU over here and the payment integrity pieces are here. It's really program integrity. It's the full kind of breadth of that. And, we've had some conversations with some of our clients about in instituting a TPE type program, because oftentimes it's not necessarily about these broad strokes of overpayments, and it is sometimes about course correction and righting the ship, which kind of gets me to the last piece, which is that, in some instances, provider groups have billers and coders in house doing the work, but they're not doing anything as a QA, a check and a balance on that, right? And so they're not bringing in a third party to say, hey, third party, I would like you to not only do an audit on our work, meaning meeting, one of the key elements of the OIG's model compliance guidance, which is self-auditing. Self-auditing doesn't always mean just having a third party look at billing and coding for accuracy and working to course correct, but it could be, what are the underlying issues? If you have a person who's working as a biller slash coder auditor in-house, and there's an error rate, is the error rate the result of the biller and coder not being trained properly themselves? So, Jason, I want to give you the last word on this, because this is a piece of the puzzle that you've talked about a ton of times, which is interoperability reporting and the importance of having a check and balance in-house, not only on the coding and the billing itself as what goes out, but the quality of the people that are there doing the work, right?
Yes. So something that we've talked about on previous podcasts has been inter-rater reliability. So in the area of medical coding, sure, it would be great to have extremely tight quality assurance mechanisms in place across the board. That's a very costly venture. So do you want to apply it across the board? And maybe so, there might be reason for it. It might be a startup organization. It might be any number of good reasons to do that. Or as an organization is up and running and going well, do you want to have quality measures assessed so that they're applied to those that need it most? And so that inter-rater reliability allows the organization to ramp up quality measures on certain particular individuals that obviously are showing that need of that intervention, and maybe slackening off a little bit on others that are really high performing and not popping up on the radar screen from inter-rater reliability assessments.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it is important that this be understood as kind of this kind of continuum of services, that it's, you know, it's on the provider side, but it's also on whoever it is that's doing this, you know, targeted probe and education, or providing this education and training, that you are giving people the best information that's available at the time. And it's founded in something other than the ether, right? You can't just say, well, because of this, you know, is there a policy? It's sort of like, you know, on our end, when we're doing and the UPICs and all the provider and all the payment integrity side, when you're denying a claim or you're changing a code from one to another, that it's founded in a policy, an NCD, an LCD, and a payer policy or something like that. So Wade, as we wrap up, I want to give you the last little bit of this, is that when, you know, on your end now, as part of a member of our SIU team, you're pitching cases constantly to the Mifuku. You're pitching cases to the leadership of the contract that you're under. When you're making these pitches, if there's a prior history of overpayment or things like that, like, what are you highlighting when you're pitching a non-patient harm case? What are sort of the couple things that you're really, like, when you make your pitch to the Mifuku, the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, or something similar, what are the things that, you know, what are your red flags that make you say, hey, this is something that I think we need to refer over?
Well, it does go back to what I was speaking about earlier, because a lot of times I think we get in the habit of you're following like a workflow, and it says, okay, if you get to this point, you should submit a credible allegation of fraud. And I think in some cases, maybe it's overlooked as to what that involves, like what the intention is with that. And that is doing a criminal referral. So that means, you know, the intent is to have a criminal case worked and ultimately prosecuted. So again, what goes back to making a successful case, criminal case in most cases, is the hardest thing to prove, and that is the intent. So if there is either like a targeted probe education, or even with our prepayment review type cases, there's usually some education. We might review a certain code or several codes for a time period, and then at some point, you know, we take some action, whether it be a referral or it might be just educating them on it's maybe less egregious, but it's like they're using a code that is not as accurate. They should be using a code that's one or two digits off, and that would make it a payable claim, right? Versus the way they're billing it now, it's not payable. But again, if it's going to be a referral to the Mifuku, as Jason said, we used to have the ability to work criminal, civil, and administrative. This is not like sending it to the OIG where they're going to decide what they're going to do, anything from criminal down to a permissive exclusion or something like that. This is going to the Mifuku, so they're going to look at it criminally. So again, it goes back to the same thing, that what really needs to be included in that is elements of the crime, which the hardest one to prove usually is that intent. So if there's previous education, that makes it much easier.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's why I think that doing something like this targeted probe and education, the TPE program that CMS has instituted, really does have some strong collateral consequences when used in the commercial or the Medicaid setting, because it really is, one, it's a tool to create an environment for antisocial behavior modification. And if a provider is not willing, after three rounds of education, to change their behavior, then, you know, that really, to me, is a great addition. And I'm a little surprised that it's not as prevalently implemented as it possibly could be for, you know, other in other payer scenarios. So look, there's a lot more to discuss about this. I think we're going to probably do this on other podcasts. We're going to talk a lot more in depth about some specific instances where TPE was brought into play in the CMS, in the UPIC, and in the payer space. We've got some future podcasts, I think, where we're going to talk about that a little bit more in depth. So as always, time goes quickly. It's amazing that we run out of time as quickly as we do, but great to see you guys. I'm sorry I did not get the memo on the color coordination of the shirts. Hopefully I'll remember to do that, you know, next time. So again, thanks everybody for joining on to our podcast. Again, if you're not getting our newsletter, send us an email, hello@advisehealth.com. We'll get you on that. You can get our podcast as part of that newsletter every week. You can also get our podcasts when after they're recorded on YouTube. Just go onto our YouTube channel, search for Advise Health. You can get them there. You can get them on Spotify. We'll also have an announcement coming out about our June LinkedIn Live. It's going to be a really exciting LinkedIn Live with a special guest. We're going to have a really good conversation about a specialty fraud scheme. So I'm super excited about that. More to come on that in the next couple of days. So as always, good to see everybody. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you at the next one.
Thanks for your time.